ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When the police raided the Stonewall Inn back in 1969, they had no idea that it would eventually lead to the birth of gay pride.
We started standing up for ourselves and said, this is who we are and you're going to accept us.
I'm Mark Fennell and I am the host of the ABC Radio National podcast, No One Saw It Coming. Each week, we unravel a moment in history that changed the course of the world, but, well, no one saw it coming. To hear it, search for No One Saw It Coming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is The Science Show with me, Belinda Smith, and back in the presenter's chair is Robin Williams. It's nice to have you back from your travels in the US, and I can see you have loads of stories that you collected along the way. So let's get into them, shall we? Robin, over to you.
Thanks, Belle. The AAAS was formed in 1848 as a scientific society involving all disciplines, and if you want to join, all nations, not just America. And this week, from its annual meeting just ended in Phoenix, Arizona, I'll bring you cuts resisted, chimps chatting, and a young woman who decided amazingly to cross the Sahara in the quest to understand baboon language. Now, try this thought experiment. Tomorrow, with no notice, you will have your income reduced by 47%. Call it by half. That was the threat from Trump to NASA, the National Science Foundation, also by a real 50%, National Institute of Health by 40%, and its institutes reduced by 8, wiped out. The total loss to scientific research, $30 billion. So meet Sudip Parikh, the distinguished CEO of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Now, I know, because I asked you last time we met, that your field is material science. But before that, you studied journalism. How come?
You know, growing up in North Carolina in the 1970s, I had visions of becoming a guy named Charles Kuralt. Charles Kuralt was a veteran journalist who worked on Sunday mornings on CBS, and he had these delightful, thoughtful, long-form conversations with people that I learned so much from. And I thought, wow, I could do that. And then I realized that a guy named Sudip Parikh probably wasn't going to be the next Charles Kuralt.
I see. So compromise, you turn to minerals. Now, since we met, of course, there's been turbulence in the United States, especially with, say, the funding of science. And the first thing I want to ask you, when you were, in a way, by you I mean American science, rescued in Congress because the cuts I saw listed for NASA and so on were unbelievable. What if they had not been resisted? What would the result have been, do you think?
Yes, I testified about this to the Appropriations Committee of the Senate, and what I said was, if those cuts become law, the United States would forfeit its position as a global leader of science. Full stop. The rest of the policy could not have made up for that type of cut.
When these politicians are alone in their rooms, not pontificating on stage and being ideological, surely their advisors would tell them of the sorts of consequences. Don't they take them seriously anymore?
They do. And I think part of what you saw here was Congress coming to its senses, remembering that they are champions of science in a bipartisan way. Remember that these bills were written by Republican chairs of the Senate and the House and appropriations, and then supported by the Democrats. And so what ended up happening was the appropriations bills that supported science passed by a large majority, a large bipartisan majority in Congress. Now, that was not because everyone suddenly came to their senses out of nowhere. There was advocacy involved. Myself testifying in front of the Appropriations Committee, graduate students writing letters to their hometown newspapers, really grassroots and from the top at institutions of higher learning, working sometimes together, sometimes in parallel, sometimes not even talking to one another, but really making the case that American science matters.
And last night you said you were surprised that there wasn't uproar around the nation when cuts of, say, 40% were mentioned. 40% of cuts to NASA. I mean, can you imagine, let alone the sort of things happening to medical research around the country? Why weren't there any huge protests? Is there too much to protest about, perhaps?
Perhaps. Although you have to ask yourself, where was that outrage? Where was the protection for institutions of higher education that have benefited the communities in which they are for decades, some cases centuries? And what it tells you is that we have lost touch. And this is a bit of self-reflection on the part of scientists and academicians. We've lost touch with our own communities. And that is our fault. And so we have to rebuild those relationships. I mean, showing up in our communities, that's not a hard thing to do, but for some reason, it's not an easy thing to do.
Community members somehow reaching out to scientific bodies or that sort of thing?
Yeah, at the AAAS, we have a program that builds relationships between faith leaders and scientists. How important? In the United States, faith matters. It's deeply embedded in our communities. And so if scientists, if a laboratory is two blocks away from a church, shouldn't those people know each other? Shouldn't they actually break bread together? You know, we're all chasing the profound mysteries of life, and we're coming at it in different ways. And so we need to have those discussions.
It's quite interesting. In Australia, there was a person called Emma Johnston. She's just died. She was the first woman to be Vice Chancellor of the University of Melbourne, which has got a wonderful record. Before that, she was at the University of Sydney, University of New South Wales. She did the State of the Environment report, going from the northern part of Queensland down to Antarctica. And she found that biodiversity was crashing all the way along, except, given what you said, where there was a relationship between the local interested community and a scientific body, however small. Does that surprise you?
It doesn't surprise me at all. When we are at our best as scientists, yes, we are trying to understand fundamental nature of materials and quarks and things that are really hard to make real for people. But when we're at our best, we're also checking the health of an ecosystem. We're checking the pollutants in a river, and we're sharing that with a community, and we are trying to make it better for our own communities in which we live and work. That's why science started probably 1,000 years ago, is someone saying, I want to try and make things better, and I need to learn a little bit about the world so I can help make it better.
Just a thought from me. I've been going to the AAAS meeting we worked out today for about 50 years. My program, The Science Show, has been on for 50 years. May I tell you that every time I go around Australia, all parts of Australia, and now here we are back in Phoenix, and I go to other places like Caltech and UCLA and so on, the science there all around is fantastic. It is intellectually and, you know, you talk about joy and passion. There it is.
Yes.
Because things are being revealed. It's amazing.
It is. I travel so much all across. Even this Annus Horribilis, is that the Latin term for horrible year? I never get that right.
The Queen quoted it, yes.
Exactly, yes. This was that year for science. And yet, even as I traveled during this horrible year, I met students and scientists who were making discoveries, who were benefiting their communities. I met scientists who were resilient. And even in a time of uncertainty and chaos, they were delivering science. It inspires awe amongst all of us. And I think it's important to remember that. It's important to see that and to know that the United States, because that funding is still there, is still a global leader in science. Now, we still have to protect. There's so many other pieces of damage being done. I have to always qualify this by saying much damage is done and there's much still yet to fight for, but we're here. We survived that horrible year and there's more to be done.
And communities should get in touch with the scientists. But when are you coming to Australia finally?
I was there a couple of years ago. I enjoyed my time. Actually, one of my favorites was when I was in Tasmania and Kangaroo Island. Both those wonderful places, the night sky is inspiring, and the animal ecosystems are wondrous and unique. And I look forward to coming back soon.
Good to see you again.
Wonderful to see you, Robin.
Dr. Sudip Parikh, the CEO of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. The annual meeting has just finished in Phoenix, Arizona, showing once more that nature is irresistibly interesting and fine minds, including you, must continue investigating its wonders. And one session at the meeting had three top editors of journals, Science, JAMA, and the New England Journal of Medicine, on a panel facing journalists. I chose to talk to Professor Domingo, editor of JAMA.
I'm Kirsten Bibbins Domingo. I'm the editor-in-chief of JAMA and the JAMA Network. I'm also a professor of epidemiology and biostatistics and medicine at the University of California, San Francisco.
Well, you would know Elizabeth Blackburn, perhaps.
Absolutely. So I started as a basic scientist. I worked in the lab of Dr. Harold Varmus, and Elizabeth Blackburn was in the lab right next door to ours. So I had a wonderful experience getting to know her even before she won the Nobel Prize.
Yes, won the Nobel Prize for wonderful work, because she grew up in Tasmania and in Melbourne and went to San Francisco. And there is a rumor that she was possibly going to be the first ever president of the Royal Society of London,
yes,
but preferred to stay in that wonderful laboratory where she works. Now, may I ask you, part of the discussion at the AAAS meeting, that is the sort of strain you are under, perhaps, as an editor of a top journal with so much dispute about science, especially around medical matters.
Yes, so there's a lot of discussion right now and a lot of polarization around these issues. I think it was nice on our discussion today to be on a panel with editors from independent journals. And the value, I think, for independent journals is that we're much more mission aligned in how we approach these things. And so I think our principles have stayed the same in what we're doing in this environment. But journals always feel the impact on the scientific community of any types of larger disputes. And so that's an area that I think we have to be very cognizant of to make sure that the best science is still coming to journals and being published. And then, as you suggest, we also have to make sure that we're communicating high quality information, working with journalists to make sure that information gets out, because we're working in an environment where there's lots of types of information out there, not always all of high quality.
And many of your readers, perhaps most, are medical professionals, aren't they?
Yes. So we're the Journal of the American Medical Association. And so our core audience is clinicians, clinicians around the world, not just US-based clinicians. So we are publishing for scientists, but we're also publishing for people who want to apply a scientific finding to improve the health of patients or the population.
And what have they tended to say in the last year about the turmoil there is about ideas in science and treatment?
Well, there's a large group of clinicians who say we should just stay out of politics. And in many ways, I don't think our journal wants to be explicitly in politics. But as was said in the panel earlier today, the job of a doctor, the job of any clinician, is to be able to provide the best care for the patient in front of them. And that most physicians, I'm a practicing physician still, we see a wide variety of patients. We know that their health is related to a wide variety of conditions. And so it is very clarifying when you're the editor-in-chief to say, should a doctor know this information? Would it help them to take care of a patient? Then we're going to publish that information. So we're less concerned about how someone else might use that for some other gain. It's very clarifying to say, if a doctor needs to know this, then we should publish it.
Whenever I come back to the United States, I'm astounded when I watch television and I flick through the channels. The amount of advertising there is for drugs, it's incessant.
Yes. Apparently only the US and New Zealand have direct-to-consumer advertising. The rest of the world is free of that. There are some who will tell you that there are some benefits to communicating directly to the consumer, but I think on balance it's a big challenge and is not on balance good, and it certainly shifts the way drugs are prescribed and things like that.
A final question. You mentioned the fluoride case in there.
Yes.
We've had fluoridation of water and toothpaste for an awful long time, and it's not that much of a controversial matter. What's been the concern, briefly, of what you've been talking about?
I think that politically, the debate about fluoride has become the poster child of, should public health interventions, is that something a federal government should focus on? Should we do a small intervention that might on balance be good, or should we let everybody just figure it out on their own? And so the science around fluoride is complex. It's not always high quality. I think many would take the public health position that on balance, it's a small intervention that on balance has health benefits. But I think the reason it becomes a lightning rod, in certainly in the US, is because it's the poster child for one of those things that the government is telling you or forcing on you, and we should just let everyone make their own decision.
Indeed, like Tylenol and so on. But thank you very much indeed. And It's been fascinating hearing the panel together.
Yes, it's been great. It's great to talk to journalists who are in the same type of position that we are, trying to get high quality information out there to the public.
But would you believe that in 2025, the amount spent on advertising drugs on telly in America was $7 billion, or 13% of national TV advertising? Add that onslaught to the misinformation industry and you can imagine the challenge to great journals like Professor Domingo's JAMA, the Journal of the Medical Association of America. Okay, so we're in Phoenix, Arizona, a city of surprises. Take a light rail 11 kilometres from the CBD to the campus of the Arizona State University. It cost me $1. And there you meet Professor Ian Gilby. Where are we sitting now?
We are sitting in the Jane Goodall Institute Gombe Research Archive, which is housed here in the Institute of Human Origins, and we're surrounded by 25 or so fire and waterproof cabinets that contain basically all of the data sheets that have ever come out of Gombe since Jane started there in 1960.
Have you looked at them all personally?
I don't think I've looked at them all, but I've looked at many of them very, very closely. So it's a mix of her own early observations, data analysis, PhD data from various students over the years, including my own. And the bulk of it is data that are collected daily by Tanzanian field assistants who follow a chimpanzee all day long, recording their behavior.
Many surprises?
I mean, we're sometimes surprised by dried out lizards and gecko eggs and things like that. But in the data themselves, I mean, yeah, sometimes we find some of her drawings, and obviously we've got the original early discoveries of meat eating and tool use and sort of complex social relationships all in there.
Were you aware of any doubts that she had? Did she write about her doubts, whether she was spending too much time way out on her own in the jungle just looking?
Not that I've seen. I mean, I know for sure it must have been very hard work, and I'm sure to some extent frustrating when, you know, because she was, these animals would just run from her when she approached them. But she was such an incredibly patient woman that she just saw the long game, I think, and just stuck it out.
It was worthwhile, yes. Well, but she wasn't scared of, because a chimpanzee is so incredibly strong. And you don't want to have an argument. And
Yeah, absolutely not. They are 5 to 10 times stronger than the strongest human, and they're quite aggressive, which is, you know, one of the things that she discovered. And so I never feel as in danger with the chimps myself. We have had a few bullies over the years who tend to incorporate humans into their dominance displays, but I never felt fear of my life, and I don't think she did either, but they're pretty formidable.
So what do you think it was, apart from she was there all the time, they got used to her not attacking her, but then engaging with her, which is even more extraordinary?
Absolutely, yeah. And that's one of the challenges of working with the chimps, actually, is that we really try very hard not to engage with them because we're there to study their natural behavior. Also, we can transmit disease to them, and their immune systems aren't tuned to the diseases that we have, and so we need to be very careful that we don't get too close. But it is absolutely fascinating when a kid comes up and, you know, looks in your eyes and sort of trying, you can tell that they're trying to figure out what you're all about.
A kid chimp.
A kid chimp, yeah.
Yes. And of course, it was romanticized even while she was starting, that here were these animals being discovered as lovable things. And of course, when we see them in zoos or something like that, they seem rather cuddly. And so it goes on. But then the news came out that some chimpanzees hunted others, and there was such a territorial drive that they could also eat other chimps. You know, this was a shocking thing. How did she adjust to that?
I think she probably wasn't terribly surprised because she'd seen a fair amount of violence within groups, within the main study community at Gombe, but it was really shocking to her and to everybody that we saw this community split. So it's only been documented one other time fairly recently, to where we have a group of the whole community splits into two, and then one side starts attacking the other. And so that was a real shock to her because she was seeing chimps who would groom each other and affiliate with each other and now suddenly killing each other. So it was a big shock, but it's one of those things that, while it's an unfortunate truth, it also says something about how human-like chimps are.
That's the point, yes. The Second World War and all those horrors that you just witnessed. Human beings, well, the chimps never.
Right, exactly. So you think about, I was just in Rwanda this past summer thinking, you know, learning about the genocide, and it's a very similar kind of thing. Suddenly people turning on their friends. And so it's, from a scientific perspective, it's fascinating because it, hopefully it can give us a sense, if we sort of understand the roots of intergroup aggression in humans, maybe we can figure out ways to combat it. We're not doing a very good job, though, I have to say.
You talked about you're studying meat eating. Mm. What aspect?
I'm interested in three aspects, I suppose, of the meat eating. The first is how they acquire the meat. So their primary prey are red colobus monkeys, which are tree-living monkeys that live in pretty large groups. And chimpanzees, mainly males, hunt them in groups themselves. So when they encounter a group of monkeys, the more male chimps that are there increase the likelihood that somebody hunts. So group hunting is one of the hallmarks of human evolution, cooperating in order to acquire a resource. And so the big question is, are chimps doing it like humans do, or is there something fundamentally different about how humans hunt and or cooperate with one another? And my work has shown chimpanzee hunting is not so complex. It really seems to be every chimp for himself. Every chimp is trying to catch his own monkey, but the actions of others help sort of facilitate that. So the more chimps who are hunting, the more likely it is that I get my own monkey.
How many different species are they? Bonobos are spectacularly and famously different. Yeah. But what about the rest?
Well, there's only one species of chimp, several subspecies, but there's one species of chimpanzee, Pan troglodytes. And yes, as you say, they are closely related to bonobos, but the more we're learning about bonobos, the more we're realizing how different they really are.
Going back to Jane Goodall and her amazing work, after she died quite recently, what did you make of the reaction of the world in its various forms?
I was blown away. I mean, I was not surprised at all. I mean, I have been with her in public situations and have seen the reaction that people had to meeting her. And she had such a presence and was just, could be so emotional to meet her. So I knew that it would be a worldwide mourning. And I was lucky enough to go to her funeral in Washington, D.C. And that was a very, very powerful experience with both people who she had touched around the world were all there. And it was a very moving experience.
The sincerity seemed to be almost 99%.
Yes, you knew what you were going to get with her. Her public persona was exactly the same as her private persona. And so what I admired about her the most was how she could just bring calm to a room. It was really amazing. Everybody would be chattering excitedly because they knew Jane was going to be visiting or whatever. And suddenly everybody would start to go quiet and you knew that she was coming down the hallway or whatever. It was. So we hosted her a number of times here and it was always a pleasure. No, I have no idea where it came from. I mean, that was the reason why Louis Leakey chose her to go study chimpanzees, because she was so quietly patient. And he felt that, and probably quite rightly, that women are generally more patient than men, and thought that she was the perfect candidate to go and learn about these amazing animals.
And those ideas for young people about the despair so many feel when they read any newspaper on almost any day, let alone about the environment. She was positive. She was saying roots and shoots are the way to go, and that was her project. Is that still going well?
I think that's going to be her lasting legacy, is the impact that she's had on young people. Because, I mean, and she really did have hope. She wrote all these books and talked all about hope, but it was true. And even in the face of all these horrible things that are happening to the environment and the world, that she really was able to find inspiring stories and was able to instill in young people the idea that they could make a difference in their own lives at the local level. You know, they didn't have to be in Africa studying chimpanzees to make a difference. They could do it in their own backyards in the US or Europe or wherever.
Finally, do you think of any people who are offshoots, if you like, people who are taking up projects in Africa or anywhere in a way that she would recognize and salute?
I mean, no one can replace Jane, of course. I mean, she was absolutely unique, but she's inspired lots of people. And her institute, the Jane Goodall Institute, is doing fantastic work in Tanzania, around Gombe, and around the world, conservation projects and so on. So the leaders of Jane Goodall Institute science team, for sure, are following in her footsteps.
And the footsteps are followed in Africa as well by Africans.
Absolutely. That was one of her major goals, was to involve, again, local people, and because it's their land, it's their chimpanzees. So it's really amazing. So I've been working at Gombe for almost 30 years now, and when I first started going in the late 90s, the area around the park, you'd travel in on the boat, and the area around the park was just bare. There was fishing villages and then just bare hillsides. There were often landslides. The village was buried when I was there, and the combination of roots and shoots and the Takari program through the Jane Goodall Institute has made an incredible difference by teaching them why it's important to have trees and how it gives them clean water and it makes the land more solid and so on. And you go now and it's unrecognizable. It's trees, woodland, the whole way to Gombe. It's amazing.
Professor Ian Gilby is a research scientist at the Department of Origins, Arizona State University in Phoenix, Arizona. This is the Science Show on ABC Radio National, coming from the AAAS. And after Ian, who spoke at the meeting, I think I met a possible Jane Goodall successor, also a Brit, based at the renowned St Andrews University in Scotland. She's Professor Kat Hobater, and her adventure with primates is really unexpected.
A wonderful talk at this AAAS meeting. There you were in the beginning with a picture of the four-wheel drive, looking out of the window at the Sahara, where there were absolutely no chimpanzees. What were you doing there and why?
I know exactly how far it was to the nearest chimpanzee because I had to check, which was about 600 miles. We were there to try to find a population of baboons that was rumored to exist in this rocky little outcropping in the middle of the Sahara. And that's because they were going to help us solve possibly the puzzle of whether or not ancient Egyptians could make Saharan desert crossings.
This little outcrop, was it not the size of Tasmania?
It's about the size of Switzerland, which on a Saharan scale is quite small.
So you drove and drove through this wasteland, deserts, not terribly much there, and great big tall rocks. And looking down from the rocks were indeed the baboons.
They were. So it was a beautiful desert, but it's true there was not very much life in it. But one of the fantastic things about baboons is that they are diurnal, so they hang about in the daytime, and they are very vocal. And so that means that even though it was very hard to know exactly where they'd be, just by listening carefully, we had a good chance of being able to spot some. And then we had to find out if they would accept us getting any closer to them. That took a few days, but we were really lucky because some of the very remote groups probably have not seen humans before. These are parts of the desert that there's just no reason to go into. And so once we'd been there for a couple of days, they actually started hanging out with us, and it was delightful. You'd be sort of working away and looking up and realizing that you had an audience of young baboons for whom I think we were the most interesting thing that had turned up all year.
Why would you think there could be? Because there were no clues saying here be baboons, except ones that were mummified or buried way up, as you said, hundreds of kilometers away. Mm-hmm. Where?
So there were mummified baboons in Egypt. So we're talking 6,500 years ago. So before the pyramids, ancient pre-Egyptians were mummifying and burying not only humans, but other animals. And the first non-humans, or the oldest non-human mummies that have been found, are baboons. And there are no baboons in Egypt. And so the most likely thing is that the Egyptians were going down the Nile, which would take you to what is modern-day Sudan or Ethiopia. But there was this crazy idea that two friends of mine had that somehow the ancient Egyptians might have been crossing the Sahara and finding these baboons that have actually gotten cut off there in the middle of the Enedi Plateau. And this seemed like an absolutely mad idea in many ways, but we were sat in a tapas bar having too many bottles of wine, and we decided that the only way to solve it was to go and give it a go. And so 2 years later, we find ourselves driving into the Sahara to try to find them. And we had a good idea that they would be there. We'd heard rumors from lots of local people that there were baboons in the general area. And baboons would have 12,000 years ago been all over that part of the Sahara, because the Sahara used to be green at that time. But now it's aridified and dried out, and the sands are everywhere around this one little, not so little, rocky island in the middle of it called Inedi, and the baboons got cut off and stuck there.
Did you study their behavior and communication?
There were all kinds of interesting behavior, though. They are living in the most extraordinary cliffs, and baboons will often sleep on cliffs, but these individuals are living their whole life climbing the kind of things I'm a climber, I'm a decent, competent climber. They're climbing the kind of things I would dream of climbing, and how they're doing it. So I would love to know more about that. But one of the things that fascinated me was that sometimes they would take a little pebble stone and they would sort of rub it against the rocks, and it would make this little noise almost of a rock about to fall, which, as anyone who spends time around cliffs knows, is an immediate danger signal. You hear a bit of rock moving and you look up. And it looks like they were using it as a just gentle threat to us. And sometimes they would, you know, that thing that cats do where they will look at you while pushing a glass off the table and just kind of stare you down. And these baboons would just hold your gaze and then poof, pop this little, very small, but just as an indication of what might happen if we weren't to behave ourselves. So I'm really interested to learn more about how they're using this rocky desert environment to communicate, to behave, what they're getting up to in there.
And you have done that same sort of study, of course, with chimpanzees, and you've noted so many gestures, not necessarily mouth language saying, oi, oi, here, here, or something like that, but ways in which the pointing and who knows what else can mean all those different things without actually having language as such as we have.
Exactly. So there are lots of things that we do with language that other apes, so the chimpanzees, gorillas, bonobos, and orangutans are doing with their gestures. And all of those little requests every day to get through life, so come here, go away, give me that food, groom me here, shall we travel there, climb on me. All of those are the kind of things that apes are communicating to each other, but they're not doing it with their vocalizations, they're doing it with their gestures. And the way in which they gesture is quite like the way in which we use our language, which is normally spoken, although we have sign forms and written forms. And we can recognize that the chimpanzees are gesturing, and then they're waiting for a response, they're waiting for an answer, because it's a back and forth. They're actually having conversations sometimes, exchanging gestures back and forth to work out what they want to do.
It's very interesting when you look at some of the people who've worked out why we have language. And of course, my namesake Robin Dunbar in Oxford has talked about coming out of the trees for various reasons, climate change, who knows. And the trees were wonderful places where the social life was often augmented by a bit of grooming, you know, looking for fleas, nice tickles under the chin and whatever. But when you go down and you're just standing there in the flat, and you do that sort of thing without looking except at your partner's infestations, you could be eaten by a saber-toothed tiger or whatever is around. So instead you use language, and Robin Dunbar thinks that that's the way it developed. Mm-hmm. The social life was augmented by saying words and talking to each other and gossip. Do you reckon that's a good idea?
Thinking about that transition into the savannah is a really important one. We actually know, so one of the chimpanzee populations that I work with is a savanna living chimpanzee population. And so one of the reasons I'm excited is to get to see what it's like for a forest ape living in the savanna. And I used to be very naive. I used to think in the savanna, it would be grassland and I could use all of these visual signals at long distances because you'd be able to see much further than you do in the forest. And actually, I then went to the savannah and realized that the grass is really quite tall, much taller than the chimpanzees and certainly almost taller than I am. And so it's actually very difficult to see in the savannah. So there might be all kinds of reasons why using your vocalizations more often or using acoustic gestures, so about half the gestures a chimp makes will have a sound, could be an advantage. But I do think that one of the things that apes are more than capable of is politicking, and if that is a sort of entryway into gossip in some ways. But gossip also has that one thing in common with storytelling, which is you're talking about someone who's hopefully not there at the time, and maybe there's some deception, some imagination coming into play when you're gossiping. And so I think gossiping and storytelling overlap quite a lot, and both of them are really interesting for thinking about language use.
And have those qualifications to the idea of Dunbar's, have you told him that, and has he answered that?
I haven't yet chatted with Robin about these ideas, although I did just put him as a reviewer on our new paper, so I'm hoping very much he likes them. But we have had good chats about what chimpanzee life is like. And I think one of the things that is really coming out now is how much we've underestimated chimpanzees in the past. And one thing that I think a lot about is that chimpanzee life, you are living 40, 50, 60 years. If you're a male, that's going to be in the same place you were born. And a female, you'll move when you're maybe 12, 13, 14. You're living with the same little group of individuals in the same place, doing the same thing over and over and over again. And you actually don't need to communicate or use language a lot of the time when you're dealing with very familiar individuals in a familiar setting doing the same sorts of things. And one of the things I think about is if I hear footsteps coming down the corridor at work at about 5 to 11, I am grabbing my coffee mug already. And my friend Bob, who is coming to let me know that they'd like to go for coffee, doesn't have to say a word. They don't even have to get to my door because I know Bob, I know what time it is, we have this familiar routine, and we might just share a nod and sort of walk out silently. And I think that's one thing we underestimate, is that our use of language today is very different from the ways we would have needed to communicate even as early humans for most of our history. So when we're thinking about how language evolved, we need to think about the kind of context it evolved in, which were these very familiar small bands that might not need to have used language the way that we need it today.
Thank you. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Well, that was the adventure with Professor Kat Hobater, Catherine to you, of St Andrews University in Scotland. But her ventures with different species to compare their gestures and communication show compellingly, just like her coffee with Bob, that you don't need language for most tasks. So why do we have it on such a spectacular scale as humans? More on that in the Science Show in a couple of weeks. Meanwhile, some star stuff from Phoenix to finish. And this professor from ASU is himself working on Hubble, fixing it, and James Webb with astonishing results. Roger Windhurst.
Well, I had to care about all kinds of science, not my own pet peeve of the distant galaxies and the black holes, but we had to make sure the telescope would work well for exoplanets, you know, when you see them go across their stars in the background, or even moving targets such as the planets in our own solar system. That was not a simple thing to, you know, make a 6-ton telescope like that, slew a Jupiter or Saturn or Mars for that matter, and not only sit still to take a picture, but move while it takes a picture, because the planet moves.
And all those things where you had to get people who are specialists to work together across boundaries. Now, on your table here, it's a delightful table in your office, a copy like that, it's black, but covered in those wonderful colours. Mm-hmm. And these are presumably galaxies, stars, and so on.
So this is the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. All 414 hours between Hubble and Webb. 365 some hours with Hubble in the blue, so filters we can see with the unaided eye, we would call them blue, green, and red. And one right at the border, around 1 micron's wavelength. And then in green and red are rendered 53 hours, one of the deepest integrations with the Webb telescope in the so-called JADES field. That stands for the James Webb Advanced Deep Extragalactic Survey that Marcia Rickey and UofA pioneered. So that data is all public, and we put it together about a year ago to show this beautiful image. And you see here about 27,000 galaxies, all the way back to maybe about 200 million years after the Big Bang. And the faintest ones you see are about as faint as a firefly seen from the distance.
No,
really? Moon, with the moon not there, yeah? So, which is about 10 billion times fainter than what the unaided eye can see. You talked about stars. There's about 7 galactic stars in this image. One of them is right there below that blue galaxy.
Oh, yes.
Everything else is a galaxy. So, in other words, you imagine you're driving through the intergalactic highway in your car or spacecraft, and you see a few drops on the windshield, 7 of them, Those are the stars in our own galaxy. Everything else, the houses, cities in the distance, are distant galaxies between a billion and about 13.5, 13.6 billion light years away from us.
So those two famous telescopes working together in different ways, of course, showing something on a scale which has never been seen before by everybody. And you can have those images on a piece of paper, a very big one, and it's tantalizing.
Yeah, well, the original image probably more than 30,000 pixels on the side. We reduced it a bit in size to fit inside a TIFF image. I think the one we made was 4,000 or 8,000 pixels on the side. The TIFF image is about 25 megabytes. Yeah, it's one of the best images we've made. There's a whole bunch of others right underneath we'll get to, but you're looking back in time all the way, almost, not quite, all the way to the beginning of galaxy formation. Yeah.
Roger, how many telescopes have you been involved with directly?
Well, just mostly Hubble since 1986. I was a postdoc at Caltech, so 4 years before it launched is when I got involved with Hubble. And then when it started in 1990, we got 3 years of lousy data, and then finally they got it fixed. And we got great data for the last 30-some years.
Who made the mistake?
Well, a company called Perkin and Elmer in Hanbury, Connecticut, made the mirror, but NASA should have caught the mistake. And of course, they had many committees and people that supervised it. But that process wasn't done right. There were conflicting results from the testing. And eventually, the NASA management went with the test that seemed to be most fitting in the tight schedule they had. Yeah. And the rest is history.
But of course, the mirror, huge. Yeah. Had to be exactly right.
Exactly.
How much was it wrong?
By about 1/1000th of the width of a human hair, I think, about 2 microns in wavelength. I think it was too shallow at the outskirts. And that causes the images of a star to be not point-like with the four diffraction spikes, but it will have that feature about, instead of 85-90% of the light properly looking like a star, it was only 15%. And the other 85% was like a huge halo around the stars. So you could see sharply, but you always had this big glow around the star. So you couldn't actually see anything faint next to a star. You couldn't find exoplanets or anything. You couldn't do accurate light measurements, which we call photometry. You couldn't easily see the black hole accretion disks in the centers of galaxies. It was just
And this was a tiny mistake like that.
Yeah. Well, it was caused by, during the polishing, they did testing often to make sure they were doing, barking up the right tree. And the test feature had a mechanical slit, an aluminum plate with a slit drilled in. And that's the right thing to do. The slit had the shape of a V, so it wasn't vertical. And somebody at some point had dropped the platelet and it was scratched. And so they mounted it upside down back into the instrument. And now the slit no longer had this feature, but that feature. And the width of that aluminum plate, which may be a few millimeters, made all the difference in the focus they were polishing towards. So they deliberately, without knowing, polished to the wrong focus for many months. And that
and after those many months, they had to go up into space and fix it.
That's right. The astronauts came on December 2nd, 1993, tested the thing to death with the corrective optics, the corrective glasses, if you wish, directly mirrors. But and they had made a simulation on the ground that had exactly this error. And then they put the corrective equipment in the beam. And lo and behold, more than 85, close to 90% of the light was in the central core, as it had to be for a perfect telescope. So then we knew, this was in the summer of 93, that if the astronauts did the right thing, that the telescope would work as advertised. And indeed, it did. It took a lot of effort. It took a lot of risk, but
They couldn't do that, of course, with the James Webb, which is beyond human reach.
Yeah, you could travel in principle with astronauts to L2, which is 4 times further away than the moon. It's only a 2-month journey. And, I talked to John Grunsfeld, the astronaut that fixed Hubble, a number of times about this. He said, Roger, I'd go anytime, You have to have 2 spacecraft, one for the equipment and one for the astronauts that do the fixing. And we thought in the early 2000s to actually have the option to fix that telescope. But then Northrop Grumman, the prime contractor, and NASA quickly said it's A, too expensive. The Hubble servicing gotten very expensive, but they had fixed other astronauts in space, commercial and military ones. So it was in low Earth orbit a fairly well understood process. It was just complex and expensive, but it could be done. With WAP, it was a whole other ballgame because you risk the lives of the astronaut more, and you have a fair chance you will mess up something because that sun shield is more than two times bigger than this room. It's, you know, the size of a tennis court. You don't want to kick that.
Yes, the adventures you have building and fixing gigantic space telescopes. More from Professor Roger Windhurst next week on how it's done. But let's end this Science Show from America with another quandary, both with money and choosing between two options when both would be perfect. Our second astronomical wizard, with what could be his last cosmic project, is Professor Jonas Zmidzinus, and he's just won a prize.
It's called the James Craig Watson Award from the National Academy of Sciences.
And what was the citation?
It was for work that I've done primarily developing superconducting detectors for astrophysics.
And what's the sort of physics that you're working on now for a new project?
So these detectors can be made to be extremely sensitive, and we are hoping that NASA will decide to build a far infrared observatory called PRIMA, which would use these detectors and would be an extremely powerful observatory operating in the far infrared part of the spectrum. These would be waves somewhere between radio waves and infrared, so shorter wavelength than radio and longer than infrared.
And what are those detectors looking at? Which part of the universe?
Well, you can use these detectors to study a very wide range of objects and phenomena in the universe. PRIMA would use them to study objects ranging from star-forming regions in our own galaxy, and especially the disks around newly formed stars, disks that might be forming planets, looking for interesting molecules in those disks, particularly water, to see.
It's so accurate.
Yes, it can do that, and it can look at galaxies in the distant reaches of the universe as well. So everything in between. It's a very powerful observatory.
And what is the process as to whether this gets recognized and paid for?
Well, NASA has to select this mission and has to provide funding for it. And that decision, we're hoping, will be made this year in 2026.
And the cuts that were suggested by Washington, D.C. weren't recognized by Congress, so they have some money rather than much less.
Correct. And I could say we're cautiously optimistic that this mission could go forward in today's climate.
Where would it be built?
It's a collaboration between the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory here in Pasadena, California, and the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. And then there would be, of course, industrial contractors assisting, so it would be built in many places. We also have a partnership with the Space Research Organization of the Netherlands. They will be supplying parts of the instrument.
So this is, to some extent, like the Square Kilometer Array, which is based in Western Australia and South Africa, where you've got a number of sites which work together somehow to give you a general image.
For large astronomy projects, that's usually the way things work, is that there are many partners that contribute in various ways. The primary funding for this space telescope, PRIMA, would come from the United States through NASA, and with some funding from Europe. So it's not, you could say, as far-flung an international project like the Square Kilometer Array, which has many international contributors.
Indeed, but there is a place where you would go to look at it.
I'm not sure what the plans are for final assembly. It may be here in Pasadena. And then at some point, it gets put on top of a rocket, like one of Elon Musk's rockets, and gets sent into space.
One of Elon Musk's rockets, I see. You don't have too many still in NASA, do you?
Well, if you want to launch payloads into space, SpaceX, through Elon Musk, is an efficient way to do it.
And he's good to work with, is he?
I can't speak from personal experience, but I think in terms of their success in launches and the amount of business they have, they're attracting quite a few customers.
When you get the results coming in for detection, is it, as with the Square Kilometer Array, essentially not a bunch of images, but zillions of numbers that have to be crunched through huge amounts of computing power.
It's perhaps not as much computing as is involved in the square kilometer array, but nonetheless, there will be substantial computing needed to be able to take the data which is transmitted from the spacecraft down to Earth and to use that data to produce images. The detectors are read out at a rather fast rate, and so there's a lot of data coming from the detectors, and you have to combine all that data to produce the image. So yes, there's a fair bit of computing.
You've hinted that this might, in fact, when it's passed, and let's hope very much it is fast, be your last major project, because it takes so long to establish a complicated telescope these days. How did you begin yourself to work in this field?
When I got my undergraduate degree at Caltech in 1981, I moved to Berkeley and I started my PhD program in physics there. And Ronald Reagan was president at the time. And we went into a recession in the United States early in the Reagan presidency. And a lot of my more senior student colleagues at Berkeley were having a tough time finding jobs with their new PhDs. And I thought, if I'm going to continue in my PhD, I better find something practical to do so I can get a job when I graduate. And so I went into astrophysics because I was going to build an instrument that involved lasers, electronics, microwaves, optics, cryogenics, and I figured something from all of that would allow me to find a job when I graduated. I was trying to be practical.
And it worked, and you've been working ever since.
Well, once I fell into astrophysics, I never got out of the rut and ended up as a postdoc at Illinois, then came here to Caltech 36 years ago. And I've been basically working in the same field ever since, this astronomy at these wavelengths. And you could say wavelengths shorter than a millimeter, the submillimeter and the far infrared. And for a physicist, it's been a lot of fun because the technology when I started was extremely primitive. Building instruments, building detectors was very difficult. A lot of development, a lot of invention was needed. And that's basically been my career, figuring out how to do astronomy at these wavelengths with ever-increasing sensitivity and power. And we're reaching the fundamental limits now with a project like PRIMA.
The choice to be made, with luck this year, between PRIMA and another called AXIS, with $1 billion for one of them. I was with Professor Jonas Zmidzinas from Caltech, where we'll also be next week. So many superstars at Caltech, which is why I go there every year.
Coming up, and speaking of space, I check out the weather on planets outside of our solar system and take a look at the viral DNA fossils that lurk in the human genome.
Thanks, Belle. Till next week. So next week, more Science in America, how lead poisoning, like the warriors in Broken Hill, is calling for an astronomer to help, how an Australian went to Caltech to launch a new branch of physics, and we get a lift on a taxi with no driver. Production by David Fisher. I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.